I'm going to draw a map here once again. I got this right here. But I may need the eraser. Zach? I got colors too. Thank you, Lou. The map. Here we go. This is, I'm going to try and make it as big as possible. This would be the Sea of Galilee. There's the Jordan River coming down here. And this would be the, well, let's put the Dead Sea up here. Use the eraser. Put the Dead Sea right about here so we get everything on there. That's the Dead Sea right there. Now, we talked last week about the Jabbok, a little river right here. Right here is Mahanaim. Mahanaim right here, which means two camps. We began last week. That is where two camps, the angelic camp and the camp of Jacob were at the same place, and Jacob saw angels there. Sent his family across the Jabbok right here. This is called the Jabbok. It's a very rugged terrain right there. Very steep cliffs. They'd gone across it, a ford there in the river. He moved on down to this place called Peniel. Peniel, which means the face of God. You can see the E-L at the end there, meaning God, Elohim. The face of God is this where he wrestled with God. As we ended the chapter last week, wrestled with the Lord, and we talked about that. Now he's going to move this place right here, still on this north side today. He's going to actually cross today over on this side. Esau is coming up this way. He's coming up from Edom. I was going to leave a little more room down here. Edom is down here, E-D-O-M, a place called Seir, S-E-I-R. That's down there, right below the area of Edom, where Esau's descendants are all going to be set. And what's going to take place now here is Jacob's going to send his family across, but he's actually going to go out in front and meet Jacob, expecting some kind of a battle. This time it appears after wrestling with the Lord, he's going to go off with the intention of just trying to appease him and just face up what's going to happen. The difference, one of the things we're going to see tonight or today, is going to be possibly the effect of prayer. Because Esau, we don't know exactly what Esau's intentions were last week. It appears he is moving with 400 men towards Jacob. And the assumption that Jacob has, the narrator has, and we have, is that there's going to be a battle, that there's going to be a confrontation. But instead today, after this night with God, it may have been one of the things that made a difference, as God says, I will make your enemies be at peace with you. That when Jacob comes across here and actually goes out in front, remember last week he was going to stay behind, let everybody else go first, he's going to read it from the back. This time he goes out in front of his family and meets Esau, and you're going to get a completely different reaction. Something Jacob didn't expect, the narrator isn't indicating that he's expecting, and as we're reading it, of course, we're not expecting this encounter this way that we're going to have. Then let me get just through this again. After this encounter, he's going to move to a place called Succoth, which is right here. I can't even spell Succoth right there. He's going to come across here to a place called Shechem. This is where our story tonight is going to take place, a place called Shechem. It's a place where the Canaanites live, the Hivites or the Horites live here. And we're going to meet a man and his son right here that we'll be talking about, Haman and his son. Just so we know what's going on. Jacob then he's going to be living in this general area outside of the city of Shechem. He's going to move on to a place called Bethel, where we know where he left over 20 years ago. He met God here, and it's been a 20-year journey. He's going to return to Bethel. And, of course, Jerusalem is just right about here. It's not an Israelite city at all, of course, at this time still occupied by the Canaanites or the Jebusites. Just so you also know, Hebron, where they're originally set up, Hebron is right down here. And Isaac is down here further down here in a place called the Negev. So kind of let you know where we're at. He's coming back here. This is where the two camps were. This is where he wrestled with God. His family is basically this side right here. And he's going to come across today. Esau is going to invite him to come down with him to Seir. Jacob is going to say, no, I'm going to go across over to this way. He's going to end up here in Shechem. And this is where our story is going to take place today. We are looking possibly today at two chapters, Genesis chapter 33 and Genesis chapter 34. We'll see how things develop. So here we go. Let's begin reading. And a couple of things that we're going to see here today, I guess we want to make a point. Prayer and an encounter with God may have changed both Jacob and the encounter with Esau. We're not sure what takes place, but he did pray. He is asking for blessing here. And if prayer is answered, that may have been what resolved right here. Because Esau's response is not what we expect. Which leads to a point here. Esau is going to be very, very gracious. And he's not a believer. He's rejected from the plan of God. But if there's anybody you'd want to meet on this particular day, it would be Esau. Which really kind of messes up some people's Christian doctrine. Some of the nicest people out there are the ones that aren't in God's plan. It's like they're fine. They're friendly. And the most dangerous people sometimes are the ones who are following God's plan, or think they are. And that leads us over here to Sechem, because the people that are in God's plan, Jacob and his sons, we're going to see Jacob kind of begin to fade to the background of the story today and almost just be an observer in many cases, not being as aggressive as he was in the past, but the aggressiveness or the action has been handed down to the sons, who now are going to, as typical, take the father's weaknesses and multiply them. Where Jacob was willing to deceive his father, deceive his brother, he would be able to connive and work against Laban and get what he wanted. His sons have seen that. And now when they are put in a position where they were, and the whole time Jacob's trying to do God's will. Do you understand? Real quickly, one of the important points here is God has a will, God has a plan, but we need to make sure we execute those things in God's way. That's why Romans 12 is so important. The renewing of your mind. That way you'll be able to discern what is good and perfect and pleasing in God's will. Because if you just got a general idea, this is what God wants, he also doesn't just want this final result. He wants things done his way to get there. And Jacob is achieving God's will, per se, but he's always doing it his own way. He's always out in front of God, manipulating things instead of following God, if you want to say it that way. Now watch his sons. There's going to be a terrible thing happen today in Sechem, something that is clearly wrong. But the way the sons respond to it is going to make the violation that took place in Sechem a minor issue compared to the way they dealt with it. So in other words, these people here, Jacob's sons, have not learned how to walk in God's ways. Although they recognize what God's will is, they do not let it happen God's way. And I'm not sure if you've ever done that before. I know I have. Of where I know what should be done, I know what is right, but then I begin to execute my plan to bring about what I know God wants. Because it reveals it in His Word. But the whole time I'm going about executing or trying to bring about God's will, I'm actually walking in violation of God's character. Have you ever done that? Okay, you don't raise your hand or something. Do you know what I'm even talking about? Tony, do you know what I'm talking about? No. Are you kidding me? Okay. I didn't know if that made sense or not. Okay, I'll give you an example. See if I can come up and put this together correctly. This is off the cuff, off the top of my head. I wasn't planning on doing this. I'm making this up. No, this is true. I just remember many years ago, I had a student in class who did something clearly wrong. And his mother came in to talk to me. And all you got to do is just sit there and stay with the facts. The child had done something wrong. And as she was talking to me and trying to defend her son, I became irate, angry, irritated. And I began to say certain things that were worse than what her son had done. In other words, I was right, her son was incorrect. But as she began to talk with me about it, I myself began to do things or say things that were wrong. In which case, the whole issue of her son being wrong never got dealt with. Guess who ended up being disciplined or punished or rebuked, reprimanded, called in on the carpet? Me. And it's like, well, what was that all about? Her son was wrong. How did it end up being my fault? Because I ended up overreacting or reacting in an inappropriate way. That's what I'm talking about. And that happens to variety. Trying to bring about what was right and clear and realize what identify the incorrect action, I myself violated something. And we're going to see that here today. There's going to be a violation in Sechem, but the way Jacob's sons bring about God's will, Jacob himself shakes his head and says, that absolutely was not what God wanted. He didn't want this, but the way they responded was incorrect. Well, let's hurry up and read this so we get through these chapters. Okay, chapter 33, verse 1. Jacob is going to now be meeting Esau. And remember, he's limping. Jacob is limping. I think he's going to limp the rest of his life from his encounter because he won the battle with God. The Lord was wrestling with him. Jacob would not resist or would not give up. And he ended up being injured because of his resistance. So he's limping. Chapter 33, verse 1. Jacob looked up, and there was Esau, coming with his 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two maidservants. So those are Bilhah and Zilpha. So he's got his four wives and their four kids in different camps. He put the maidservants, that's Zilpha and Bilhah, up front, and their children. Now, I mean, this is you know, do you have any favorite sons? Well, Jacob does. He's got rank and order. Who's gonna face the wrath of Esau first? He puts his maidservants and their sons up forward first. Leah and her children came next. And then finally, Rachel and Joseph. Remember, Benjamin's not born yet. Rachel and Joseph in the rear. But listen, here's a change. The night before, he had stayed behind. Now he comes across and he now puts himself up front. He himself went on ahead and bowed down to the ground 7 times as he approached his brother. Maybe because of his encounter with God, maybe because of his prayer, maybe he's got confidence, maybe he realizes something that he's got to face his opposition here. But he goes off in front. And your two reactions here are going to be different. Jacob, as he sees Esau approaching, is way overbound, trying to humbly present himself. He bows down not once. He bows down not twice. He bows down 7 times. It's an excessive amount of humbling himself before Esau. Bowing down, getting back up, bowing down again, trying to tell Esau, I am not a threat. And he's been scared of Esau for 20 years. Now watch Esau's reaction. He's expecting a conflict. But Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him. That is not what anybody's been expecting as the story's been coming. 400 men are approaching. Jacob's got his camps divided up trying to figure out how he's going to meet Esau. He's been sending off waves of animals trying to appease the anger of Esau. That last time he saw Esau threatened he would kill Jacob. And so Jacob now finally goes off in front, meets his fear after having prayed about it and spent a night with God, and bows down humbly 7 times, just hoping for the best. But instead, Esau runs towards him and embraces him. It's like Esau is the one who is forgiving. Esau is the one who overlooks all the offense and embraces Jacob, threw his arms around his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Then Esau looked up and saw the women and children. Who are these with you? He asked. Now remember, the last time he saw Jacob was over 20 years ago. Jacob left with nothing. And you're going to see how much he's got. Even we've already explained that, but you can continue to see how many possessions he has gained. He's already sent droves of flocks and animals ahead. The people of Shechem are going to recognize the power and wealth of Jacob, the one man in his family, and they're going to want a covenant with this man. Well, anyway, Esau recognizes this. He says, who are these with you? Now, we'll notice how Jacob answers. He doesn't say, these are my family. He says, they are the children God has graciously given. Notice, gives the credit to God, but also notice, has given your servant. He doesn't say, these are the children God has given to me. He identifies himself not as me, but as your servant, Esau, still trying to appease. He's got two people here he's been at odds with, if you would, or two personalities, God and Esau. And in this case right here, he says, these are the children of the family that God has graciously given to me. I didn't deserve them. I was just given them by God. And I myself am your humble servant. They are the children God has graciously given your servant. Verse 6, then the maidservants and their children approached and bowed down, realizing they could come out from behind their camels. There's not going to be a battle today. They bowed down. Last of all came Joseph and Rachel, and they too bowed down. Now, if you figured out, Jacob is probably around, 8, 10, 11 years old. Joseph is around 8, 10, 11 years old, and the other children are, 7 or 8 years older than that, right in that ballpark, something like that. Esau asked, what do you mean by all these droves that I met? After the children are introduced, he says, now, what was that with all those animals? I met droves of animals kept coming after me. I kept thinking it was you. Then here comes another flock of animals. Jacob says straight up, he says, to find favor in your eyes, my lord, he said, I'm trying to appease you. But Esau said, I already have plenty, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself. So again, Esau himself has been successful in his own career for the last 20 years. He's got plenty. He's been working alongside of his father Isaac, probably at some level. He says, I've got plenty. I don't need these. And obviously Jacob isn't like drained his account. He's still got plenty of stuff there for himself. But Jacob goes on and says in verse 10, no, please, said Jacob, if I have found favor in your eyes, accept these gifts from me. For to see your face is like seeing the face of God now that you have received me favorably. And that may be an indication that this prayer that he prayed before he crossed and that he met God, remember, Peniel means what? Face of God. He says, I've seen the face of God. And now he says, coming down here, to see Esau is like seeing the face of God. Then he goes on and says, now that you have received me favorably. In other words, I see God's hand in this. That you've received me favorably, I recognize the face of God that I wrestled with all night before. I prayed about it, I wrestled with God, and I see that he has changed the circumstances. So again, right there, Jacob recognizes, again, maybe a change right here is the idea that trusting God. We talked last week about how Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob knew God as Almighty. But God tells Moses, by my name Yahweh, I did not make myself known, or I did not let myself be known by them. In other words, there was this part right here of there's more to God. And that's one thing we need to understand. Again, the book of Ephesians, we're doing Ephesians on Tuesday nights. Going through Ephesians on Tuesday nights, and the emphasis in that chapter 1 throughout of Ephesians is Paul is praying that the people would know the Word of God, that they would understand the revelation of God. It's all true. I mean, if you've accepted Jesus Christ, the power has been released in your life. You are saved. There's nothing more that you need, but you do need understanding of who God is, of what His will is, of what He's done in your life, and not just knowledge, but a revelation and understanding, because I believe throughout the New Testament, I don't even think this is a stretch, I think this is one of the basic doctrines of the New Testament, is that if you can understand the truth, if you can understand what God is and what He has done, it will change your life. Because it's out there, it's true, it's already happening, it's just we don't identify it. And we have different priorities, we have different principles, we make our decisions in different ways, void of that understanding. We don't understand God. We don't understand His ways. We don't have a revelation of who He is. Many times we don't even have any knowledge of Him. We don't even have any basic Bible knowledge. And again, Bible knowledge, knowing this story is not like the ultimate experience of Christianity. This is basically information. But that information has to be foundational in your life, in your understanding of who God is, so that you can now understand Him, receive revelation of His character, and then make application to your life. If you skip this chapter, if you skip the Bible knowledge, you're just going back to the world in darkness, trying to find your way through. So, what I'm saying here is Jacob appears to have had some kind of an understanding. So, I mean, he wrestled with God at Peniel all night long. He was injured. He didn't submit, but he had to make some kind of connection. He had to have some kind of understanding because he is a changed man. He is going to be a changed man throughout the rest of the chapters. He has experienced a level of God that he only wishes his sons could figure out. And so we see this here. Jacob now is saying to him, again, for to see your face is like seeing the face of God. I'm in verse 10, meaning I now recognize the face of God in Esau. I now recognize the hand of God in this situation. I now recognize that prayer makes a difference. I recognize this is amazing. I was afraid I was going to be slaughtered by 400 men, but the way you're behaving, now that I've been received by you, God is working here. Now that is what we want. We don't want to live our whole lives trying to fight and accomplish God's will as much as we want to live our lives working and following God's will. And I think right here, instead of trying to like sneak and deceive, although he did send off a bunch of gifts, instead of trying to manipulate the situation, which again he's having a tendency to do anyhow, he now realizes God is working. I've just got to do my part, do it the right way, and God is working in my life. God is working in my situation. And I think that's something he's going to learn here. Chapter 34, we're going to see his sons have not yet learned that. Verse 12. Then Esau said, I'm going to go back and read verse 11. Please accept the present that was brought to you, for God has been gracious to me, and I have all that I need, Jacob says. And because Jacob insisted, Esau accepted it. And it was kind of, for Jacob, it was kind of like, will you take a gift from me? And he said, well, yeah, I will take it, but I don't need it. Why don't you keep it? He says, because this is important that I give you something. Esau says, okay, I'll take it. Then Esau said, let us be on our way. I'll accompany you. Let us be on our way. In other words, he says, come on. He's going to take him back with him. He's going to say, let's go back to Seir. Let's come on down here, down to the Negev, down south. Let's go back home. Let's go home, Jacob. But why do that? Jacob asked. Just let me find favor in the eyes of my Lord. All I want is favor with you. Just let me know everything is okay. I don't need to go back with you. Just let me know things are okay. So that day Esau started on his way back to Seir. Jacob, however, went to Succoth, where he built a place for himself and made shelters for his livestock. That is why the place is called Succoth. And that was right down here, this place right here. Went back over here in this location right here by the Jordan. And made some places. He lived there for a while. Set up some shelters there. Verse 18. After Jacob came from Padan Aram, he arrived safely at the city of Shechem in Canaan and camped within sight of the city. So now from the ending of what I just said, he camped here and made shelters. He now has crossed over and makes his residence just outside of the city of Shechem, a Canaanite city. Hivites are living there. And this is setting the stage for the next story. Verse 19, for 100 pieces of silver he bought from the sons of Hamor. This is an important name. The king or the leader of the city is Hamor. And he's going to buy, Jacob is going to actually purchase land. Just like Abraham bought land, now Jacob is going to buy land. This land is going to, you're going to catch up with this land on his deathbed or as he's dying. He's going to dedicate this land or give this land to Joseph, to Joseph's sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. He's going to give this land that he bought just outside for 100 pieces of silver. And it's going to eventually be the place, if you don't mind just rushing ahead in the story, this is the place where Joseph's bones are going to be brought back and buried. Joseph, remember, Joseph's bones are going to be placed in a sarcophagus for 400 years. They are brought out with the Exodus. They wander around with them for 40 years in the wilderness. They bring them across the Jordan. They keep them there at Gilgal for a while they fight the battles. And when everything is set, they bring them back up here to this land, and that is where they're buried, on the land that Jacob just bought. Well, here we go on. Verse 19, for 100 pieces of silver he bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem. Now don't be confused. The name of the city is Shechem. The name of the king or the leader is Hamor, but the name of the Hamor's son is Shechem also. So the name of the city is Shechem. The name of the king's son or the leader's son is Shechem. Where he pitched his tent. He bought some land where he pitched his tent. Verse 20, there he set up an altar and called it El Elohi Israel, which you can look down in your notes means God, the God of Israel, or the Mighty is the God of Israel. So he recognizes the God of Israel. Notice when he says Israel, he's not talking about the nation Israel. Who is Israel? Israel is Jacob. Israel is his new name. Because the Lord called him, your name shall now be Israel. You've struggled with man and God and have overcome. This is Israel. So the God, he sets up an altar right here to the God, the Mighty God of Jacob, or the God of Israel. All right, chapter 34. Now, we know of the 11 sons of Jacob. We've talked about them. We've identified them. They've been traveling along. But along in this whole story is a girl named Dinah. All we know about Dinah is that she is Leah's daughter. It's all it says. Leah also had a daughter named Dinah. That's all we read earlier in an earlier chapter. Boom, there it is. There she is. Now, she's grown up, and we begin a chapter now about this girl, Dinah. Now, Dinah, the daughter of Leah, the daughter Leah had born to Jacob, went out to visit the women of the land. And visit means that she was going into their homes. She was out interacting with the women of Shechem. And so she's probably in the city of Shechem visiting ladies of her own age or ladies just out visiting, interacting with them. She's not just sitting in a tent somewhere. She's interacting. Just like we saw up north in Padan Aram, Rachel and Rebekah were both out on their own, watering their father's flocks. They're out moving about in society on their own. Same thing here. Dinah is out moving in society alone. I mean, traveling and visiting the women. That's what that word means. When Shechem, now we know who he is, son of Hamor, or Shechem ben Hamor, that's what it means, ben, son of, the Hivite, some say Horite, the ruler of that area, saw her, he took her and violated her. So apparently he sees her, physically recognizes her as a beautiful woman, takes her, violates her. In other words, he had intercourse with her. We don't know much about the situation. You could play this off as basically what it says is just it was wrong on what he did. Was she a willing partner, whatever it was? But he was the one who initiated it. Whatever took place, he was wrong and violated Dinah. The ruler of that area saw her, and the ruler's daughter takes her and violates her. Verse 3, his heart was drawn to Dinah, daughter of Jacob, and he loved the girl and spoke tenderly to her. So apparently there was a physical, we could read a lot into this, and you could break down all these Hebrew words, but there was a physical attraction. He violates her inappropriately outside of marriage. But yet it says he was drawn to the girl. His heart was drawn to the girl. So now he's having some kind of, not just a physical attraction, he's now got some kind of mental attraction. We'd say he's now fallen in love with this girl. He now is not just a physical thing. He now wants a relationship with this girl. Now, this is interesting right here. And spoke tenderly to her. The literal Hebrew says he spoke upon the heart of the girl. He spoke upon the heart of the girl. In other words, he first manipulated her on the outside physically, but now that he's got feelings for her, he begins to manipulate her heart with words. He's now in the phase of saying nice things and manipulating her so she will have the feelings for him that he's got for her. So here you can see, this is used other places in the Old Testament, this very line right here, to speak tenderly or to speak upon the heart of a girl, and it's usually used in a negative sense. It's usually used in a way of manipulating someone by saying things to the woman to get her to respond in a certain way. Again, that's one of the tools a man would have, is to try and manipulate the heart of the woman, positive and negative. Okay, we've got a whole kind of teaching right there. Is just like it says in Ephesians, the husband is to love the woman, and the woman or the wife is to respect her husband. Because it goes back to the basic principle. If a husband is loving and saying tender things or speaking upon the heart of his wife, that's going to take her from the place of simply respecting her husband and is going to reflect back the love that he's put in. So what you put in is what you're going to get out. And in the negative sense here, he's trying to manipulate her heart so she'll have feelings for her. In the positive sense, that's exactly what a husband's supposed to do, is you speak into the heart of the woman, you speak tenderly to the heart of your wife, and she then responds back. Very appropriate in the marriage situation. In this case, maybe a little bit of manipulation going on here, but let's read on. So, he sees her physically, he violates her, he has feelings for her, and now he's speaking upon the heart of the girl. And Sechem said to his father Hamor, get this girl as my wife. Now again, the word girl is a little less honorable than maiden or son of Jacob or daughter of Jacob. Get this girl for me. Sounds similar to, remember, Samson telling his father, go down here and get this woman from the Philistines. But he says to Hamor, the ruler, get this girl. I want this girl. Now you've got to admire, again, now watch. This is the violation. This is wrong. What he's done is wrong. But he's following up on it. Even the law of Moses recognizes this very thing. And he says, I love this girl. I want this girl. Now, somehow we got to figure out how we can get her, because I want this girl. Verse 5. That's where we leave Sechem and Hamor in that condition. When Jacob heard that his daughter Dinah had been defiled, his sons were in the fields with his livestock. Now notice, this is the first time in 20 years Jacob has not been in the field. So Jacob is back home in the tents. His sons are taking care of the family business now. He's in the early phases of retirement, possibly. Or maybe just managing the family business. But nonetheless, he's not out doing the hard work. So his sons are in the field. Notice what it says. So he kept quiet about it until they came home. Jacob finds out his daughter has been defiled, and he keeps quiet. Well, I mean, there's several options there that we could throw around, figure out what is going on there. Maybe he feels powerless without his sons, because they're really the force now. Maybe he doesn't know what to do. Maybe he doesn't care. Maybe he's trusting God. I mean, what is taking place right here? But the point right here, Jacob doesn't do anything. Now, I want you to compare. You say, well, that's probably a natural reaction. Okay, we jump ahead a few chapters, and when Jacob is told, is this your son's robe that you gave him? Is this Joseph's robe? It looks like he was torn up by wild animals. Does Jacob remain quiet about that? Jacob instantly goes in the morning, rips his clothes, and refuses to be comforted because his son has been torn up by wild beasts. Again, that's a little different than being violated, but at the same time, for a woman, this not much word. I mean, this is about one of the worst things that can happen to a woman. And Jacob's like, wait until my boys get home. I mean, is he scheming, or is the author just letting it sit there because we're actually not focused on Jacob, but we're focused on this next generation, how they're handling it? A lot of things could be said right there. I'm just pointing out, I don't really have a specific answer for you except to say, when Jacob heard that his daughter Dinah had been defiled, his sons were in the fields with his livestock, so he kept quiet about it until they came home. So somehow he hears about it, but he himself does not react. Why? We just gave you several options. Verse 6, then Shechem's father Hamor went out to talk with Jacob. Now Jacob's sons had come in from the fields as soon as they heard what had happened. So apparently Jacob, his action was, I'm going to tell my boys. I'm going to get my boys involved in this. That may have been, he's quite, maybe he's saying, oh, okay, if I did something, that'd be something impressive. But if I released 11 of my sons on this, I bet they've got a better idea. Not sure. We don't know this yet until towards the end of the story, but Dinah has not come home. She's not come home. She has been taken, and apparently, and you make your own decision as you read this, she is still living in Shechem. She's been taken into someone's house in Shechem. Remember, she's visiting. She's moving about freely. She's coming here. She's been taken in by Shechem, the son, and apparently she's still in there, still in the city. And you can see that clearly at the end of the story. But the sons come home. They hear about it. They came home from the fields right away. So in other words, this is a big deal. They leave their business, whatever they take care of there, they're leaving it in the hands of servants or something, and they come in and they have a family council. Now Jacob's sons had come in from the fields as soon as they heard what had happened. They were filled with grief and fury. Grief, they're upset, but also there's anger about this. Because Shechem had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, a thing that should not be done. Now, the author's pointing out this should not be done. Clearly, this is wrong. There's no way of saying, well, you understand. There's no way of justifying this. This was wrong. So if you look at that as the author saying that, it's okay, it's understandable. The author, the narrator, standing back and saying, this is a violation. But now you play, now just be careful here. You can get a little bit of this, what I was talking earlier about, of following God and becoming the hypocrite. And by the time you get done, this again, we're never going to justify what happened here with Shechem and Dinah. But what's about to happen makes this look like not that big a deal. And again, it is, but what's going to their reaction is overbearing. So it goes on. You've got here some hypocrites trying to take care of business. Verse 8. But Hamor said to them, the sons, he's talking to Jacob and the sons, my son Shechem has his heart set on your daughter. Marry with us. Now again, when he says in the Hebrew, when he says your daughter, he's not just talking to Jacob. In the Hebrew, he's talking to Jacob and the sons. So he's recognizing this whole group of men, Jacob and his sons, as this is your daughter. This is the woman that you're protecting. My son has his heart set on your daughter, the woman that you're taking care of. And he says to him, he says, please give her to him as a wife. We want her to come to us and we will take her into our family. Then he goes on and says, intermarry with us. He says, let's intermarry with our cultures. Let's let this be a beginning, a new beginning of something great, of where we come together. And he goes on and gives them, there's three things. He says, if you'll intermarry, he goes, give us your daughters and take our daughters for yourselves. And it says, he said, we'll open up our gates. You can have our daughters for marriage, not for violation. He's not saying, you can have our women, we'll have your women. He says, we'll take your women in marriage and you can choose from our women and marry them. In other words, this is a contract. This is a covenant. He says, this is great. And there's three things he's going to give them. He's going to say, you're going to have a peaceful coexistence between our two communities. We're going to have access. You can have access and mobility within our land. And the third thing is, there'll be potential of purchasing more land from us. So here's what he just is going to say that. Give us your daughters and take our daughters for yourselves. He says, you can settle among us, I mean, live peacefully with us. The land is open to you. Travel wherever you want. Live in it, trade in it, and acquire property in it. He says, you can start buying our property. He says, come on, we'll be the same people. Now, right away, there's a flag goes up right there. This is exactly what Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob have been avoiding. That's why Abraham was up here for 20 years marrying the two daughters of his family. Remember, Rachel sent him up there. Rebecca sent him up there so that he would not marry a Canaanite. Isaac doesn't want him marrying a Canaanite. And Abraham sent his servant up there to get a wife, Rebecca, so that Isaac himself didn't marry a Canaanite. So we've had three generations avoiding marriage with the Canaanites, and now the Canaanites say, okay, hey, we can resolve this, let's just get intermarried. This could be an example of what I was talking earlier about during communion, about the ways of the world. In a state of darkness, you have a sin in your own life, But then your next hope, when you've got sin in your own life, is to look into the world and say, which way is the world going? Maybe I can find some direction from the world. No, you can't. The world is the cosmos system in rebellion towards God. And so in this case right here, the sons of Jacob are looking for direction, or being presented at least with some direction from a Canaanite. A Cedric says, hey, this would be great if we just intermarried with each other. Hey, no, it wouldn't. We spent three generations avoiding this very thing. But watch how they play it. Then Sechem said to Dinah's father, verse 11, and brothers, let me find favor in your eyes, and I will give you whatever you ask. Make a price for the bride and the gift I am to bring as great as you like. He says, a blank check, the bride price, whatever you want for this girl, I will give it, and it will represent the beginning of a new society of us coming together. He says, make the price for the bride and the gift I am to bring as great as you like, and I'll pay whatever you ask me. Only give me the girl as my wife. Excuse me, that was Sechem now. That's the boy talking now, saying, I'll pay whatever you want, but I want this woman. Verse 13, because their sister Dinah had been defiled, Jacob's sons replied deceitfully. Surprise, surprise. You can see the storyline continuing right here. Jacob, I'm sure I'll talk to my sons about it. Sons, what do you want to do? Well, we want to speak deceitfully. Isn't that what you always did, Dad? Except we're going to do it worse than you've ever seen. They are going to speak deceitfully. Now they think because this was a violation, they can now justify their own sin. Because now watch, you get in this own trap yourself. Well, you sinned against me, so I'm going to resolve it by sinning against you, and I'll be justified. That's an example of the ways of the world. When you're not following God's plan, that's a vigilante. That's like, I'll get you before you get me, or you got me, so I'm going to get you back. That's how they're going to solve the problem. But they're trying to accomplish God's will by walking in the ways of the world. Here we go. Verse 13, because their sister Dinah had been defiled, Jacob's sons replied deceitfully as they spoke to Sechem and his father. They said to him, we can't do such a thing. We can't give ourselves to a man who is not circumcised. Now, again, if you go back to circumcision, chapter 17, circumcision was a sign. Now, this is important. Circumcision was a sign of the covenant. Abraham, his sons, in fact, his entire household, including foreigners, were circumcised as a sign of the covenant. Circumcision indicated you believe in the covenant made to Abraham. The promise of the Messiah. The promise of God blessing the nations. The promise of a chosen nation that is going to be a blessing to the nations. Circumcision was not just for Israel. Circumcision was for anyone who entered into Israel's covenant with God. There were aliens for circumcised, foreigners that were circumcised, but it was based on the fact that, do you want to enter into this covenant? Yes, that's why the book of Galatians was such a big deal, because that was the way the Jews perceived Gentiles joining the covenant. You've got to be circumcised. And Paul says, not any longer. We've changed dispensations. But until that time, that is how a Gentile would have shown an agreement with the covenant. They would have become circumcised. But they're not talking about faith. They're not talking about entering a promise. They're not talking about Messiah or God's covenant with Abraham. They're simply going to use a religious ritual that they've got to manipulate it to their own advantage. Have you ever seen that done before? Well, maybe. You've been around long enough. Something wholesome that God has intended to be used to perpetuate the truth gets a hold of people who are hypocrites, who then turn it to their own advantage to gain power over somebody else or power over their congregation. And you can fill in the blank, whatever you want. There are probably things you never even thought of are being done. They said to them, we can't do such a thing. We can't give our sister to a man who's not circumcised. That would be a disgrace on us. And you know how we are so particular about our rituals and our religion. We will give our consent to you on one condition. And one condition only. That you become like us by circumcising all your males. Now again, it's easy to circumcise an 8-year-old boy. But now to circumcise everyone from the king down. Then we will give you our daughters and take your daughters for ourselves. We'll settle among you and become one people with you. Here's their promise. But if you will not agree to be circumcised, we'll take our sister and go. So now here's their alternative. It says, if you get circumcised, we'll join you peacefully and we'll interact with you economically and we'll be one big happy culture. But if not, then you're going to face the alternative. We're going to take our sister and go home. Now, that's not what they're going to do, more than take their sister and go home. But they're leaving it sit right there. What do you want? So, well, here they go. The proposal seemed good to Hamar and his son Sechem. Now, you got to understand, there's got to be some serious economic advantage that they're looking at here for the leader and his son to go, oh, sure, we'll do that today. It's like, holy smokes, just think about it. But nonetheless, their proposal seemed good to Hamar and his son Sechem. The young man who was the most honored of all of his father's household, Sechem, lost no time in doing what they said because he was delighted with Jacob's daughter. He said, look, I'm already done. So Hamor and his son Sechem went to the gate of the city to speak with their fellow townsmen. Now what they're going to do is speak to every, basically what they're going to be speaking to is every man who's of military age. In fact, the phrase is coming up right here when it says, went to the gate of the city to speak to their fellow townsmen. That word right there, down in verse 24. All the men who went out of the city gate agreed with Hamar. When it says, who went out of the city gate, this refers to people who could bear arms at the city gate in the defense of the city, and when the battle came, they could exit the city gate in battle. So that's what they're saying. The men who could exit the city gate in battle, that's what it's talking about. So everyone who is of military age, able to fight, that's who Sechem, the son, and Hamar, I spelled that wrong at the very beginning. You guys been watching that all day? Their proposal seemed good to Hamar and his son Sechem. The young man who was the most honored of all of his father's household lost no time in doing what they said because he was delighted by Jacob's daughter. Verse 20. So Hamar and his son Sechem went to the gate of their city to speak to their fellow townsmen. These men are friendly toward us, they said. These men are really, really friendly. Let them live in our land and trade in it. The land has plenty of room for them. We could definitely handle more people and more flocks in our land. And he says the advantage would be then we can marry their daughters and they can marry ours. But listen, but the men will consent to live with us on as one people only on the condition that our males be circumcised as they themselves are. Then here's a catch right here. Here's the point. Verse 23. Won't their livestock, their property, and all their animals become ours? He says, look at what they've got. If we'll engage in business with them, we can get everything they've got. So let us give our consent to them, and they will settle among us. They'll stay right here, and then we can just start working on their economy. Well, the men of the city, the men of that fighting age, verse 24, all the men who went out of the city gate agreed with Hamar and his son Sechem, and every male in the city was circumcised. Try that legislation sometime in Iowa. Verse 25. 3 days later. Now, 3 days, this means right here, again, I got this out of a book. It's not like, I know anything about this. But it says 3 days later. And the reason, why is that important? Because that is when the pain would be the greatest and infection and fever could possibly be setting in. So this would be where the pain is the greatest and the men are the weakest. Okay, because it's more than just an injury. It's now dealing with fever, infection, different things like this. 3 days later, while all of them were still in pain, two of Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, this is the number 2 and 3 son. Remember, Reuben's the oldest, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Now, it's interesting that the oldest son should be the ruler, but it is interesting also to notice that the fourth son, Judah, is going to be the line of the kings because the first son is rejected, the second, third son are rejected. The fourth son is the one who becomes the ruler, or the king line. But nonetheless, Simeon and Levi. And don't forget this, because this is going to, this right here, you'd say, how come are we talking about this? Well, it's in the Bible, that's why. But how come it makes a difference is because this is going to continue to play out into Jacob's death, his prophecy about the tribes of Israel. It's going to play off into the lives of the people up until the days of Moses. In fact, the priesthood, the Levitical priesthood, is going to be tied into this. Do you understand what I'm saying? This affects everything all the way through the rest of Israel history. What happens right here? It sets the stage. I will mention this right here. Levi, this Levi right here, it's Moses' great-grandfather. Okay? Two of Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, of course, they're both daughters or sons of Leah, took their swords when the men were at their weakest and attacked the unsuspecting city. Last they heard that these were friendly people out here wanting to trade with them and marry their daughters. And all they had to do was one simple thing, get circumcised. But now they attacked an unsuspecting city, killing every male. They slaughtered every male in the city. They put Hamor and his son Sechem to the sword, and here it is, and took Dinah from Sechem's house and left. So apparently, Dinah, either she's been there since the very beginning, or some kind of agreement, she went and lived with Sechem right away when the agreement was made, but she has been living, and they now take her, and the wording there is to recover her. Take her back as plunder. Meaning she's been taken from them, and that's what gives the impression she's been living there this whole time. And they now have attacked the city, bring their sister back home. Now, there's two things that are going to take place. There's going to be the slaughtering of the city, and there's going to be the plundering of the city. Just so you know, both of them have equal amounts of words. And the description of the slaughter of the city has the same number of Hebrew words as the description of the plunder of the city. Because Simeon and Levi do not just slaughter the men and bring their sister back. They then go, well, since everybody's dead, let's take what they've got. So it's like, what an economic move for them. Verse 27, it says, they took Dinah from Sechem's house and left. The sons of Jacob came upon the dead bodies and looted the city where their sister had been defiled. They seized their flocks and herds and donkeys and everything else of theirs in the city and out in the fields. They took the entire city. They carried off all their wealth and all their women and children, taking as plunder everything in their houses. Now, do you understand? I mean, can you imagine coming into a city and plundering, not just stealing from the Quick Trip or the Casey store, but I mean plundering every house in the city? I mean, you've got every DVD player, you've got every television set, you've got all the loose change, you've got everything. In fact, now you just claim the property. It's all yours. I have no idea what they did with the women and the children. What did they do with the women and the children? I don't know. But they plundered the whole place. He goes on, they carried off the wealth and all their women and children, taking as plunder everything in the houses. Verse 30. Oh, Jacob's going to say something now. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, you have brought trouble on me by making me a stench to the Canaanites and the Perizzites, the people living in this land. We are few in number, boys. And if they join forces against me and attack me, I and my household will be destroyed. He says, you have made a big political mess for me. He says, you guys did great against one city. But he says, if those cities around join forces against us, he says, we're going to be destroyed. He says, what were you thinking? Now, again, they were thinking just like they were taught. They were acting exactly like their father acted. It's just that one of the problems that we see with the generations, you know, the whole four-generation thing, is that sin increases. Jesus, when he told the parable of the sower sowing the weeds, it says when the bad seed was sown, it began to grow. It's going to grow throughout time. Evil does not just level off. Evil tends to increase. And this is what he's looking at. Jacob is appalled. Jacob, the deceiver, is appalled at their deception. But they replied in defense, should we have treated our sister like a prostitute? What, Dad, do you think that was good that they treated her like a prostitute? What, now you're defending Sechem, Dad? It's like, what's Jacob? Nowhere to turn. It's like, what? This just wasn't right, guys. We should have handled this in a more godly way. But they missed it. Do you understand the point right there? They're saying they treated her like a prostitute, so we killed the entire city. Jacob says, I don't think that's what God intended. God didn't intend for her to be violated, but he didn't intend for you to slaughter the entire town, boys. And here's the situation right here, Romans 12. You've got to know the word. You've got to understand these things so you can test and approve what God's will is. Does God want you to destroy the city? Or does God want you to resolve the situation in some other manner? Well, I can't think of any other answer except to destroy the city. Okay. That's probably because you don't know anything else. Maybe we should examine God's ways. And that goes to all of our lives. There are situations that are coming up, and we live in a fallen, evil world, then we're surrounded by people with sin nature, including me. And things come and things go. And just because someone has done something wrong doesn't mean we overcome that with more evil. Do not overcome evil with evil, Paul writes, but overcome evil with good. It's not to say right here, and so you just ignore the evil. You're supposed to expose the evil. You're supposed to confront the evil. But as you confront the evil, make sure you don't destroy the city and slaughter all the men and say, well, that's what they treat our sister like a prostitute, so we killed them all. No, I don't think that was right, guys. And we know it's not right because they're going to suffer the consequences because of their decision. God, they're going to be cursed by God. cursed by Jacob, and they're not going to be given land. When it comes time to divide the tribal land up in Israel, Simeon and Levi do not get any land. They're rejected because of their uncontrolled anger. So the point that we've seen today is when it becomes time to act, you've got to know something about God's character, something about God's will, so that you choose the right course of action, not just react in the ways of the world. If all you know is the ways of the world, yeah, it's going to make sense to you and all your brothers around you. Yep, that's what we're going to do. And you can see our culture's in that many situations right now. It's like everybody's walking the ways of the world. What should we do? Well, let's do it this way. It's the only option. If we knew the Word of God as an individual, as a family, as a church, as a nation, there's a lot of other options out there than some of the things that we're doing. Well, I'll quit with that, and we'll continue next week where Jacob returns to Bethel. He's going to now leave Shechem. I wonder why. He's going to move down here to Bethel and reestablish his covenant with God. We'll continue talking about more and more about Jacob's sons here as Genesis closes. Father, we do thank you for your truth. We thank you for your word and do ask that we may walk in your ways, that we may understand your truth. We again thank you so much for this church. We thank you for your spirit that lives among us. And ask that we again might be salt and light at this time in history. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.